is the chairman of a foundation called the Woods Fund of Chicago. We gave some money to ACORN, but I was very skeptical of ACORN as an organization. I think they do some good things, as far as I can tell, and some not so good things. But they are a community organization, and I'm a huge believer in community organizing. I don't think ACORN is the only model. I mean, one of the things that I did when I was in this position in Chicago is I argued that the Chicago model of community organizing, which is very much the ACORN model, that is knocking on doors and getting power blocks together to fight for a certain kind of reform, is only one model. There's another model that I like very much, which is kind of comes out of the Highlander Folk School, or comes out of the thinking of Paulo Freire in Brazil. And this is the notion that organizing is not simply about low-level politics in the sense of winning a demand or winning, but it's really about education. Organizing can be thought of as kind of education for life and deeper consciousness raising. Do you guys know the Highlander Folk School? It's worth finding out about. It's where all the civil rights activists in the 60s trained. And Rosa Parks was there the summer before she sat in. And Martin Luther King trained there, and Andrew Young, and Ralph Abernathy, and the SNCC kids. SNCC was founded at Highlander, actually. It's a wonderful, and it was run by a brilliant guy named Miles Horton. So I think that community organizing takes many forms. ACORN is one form, but there are many others, and I tend to support it as a... You know why I support it? Because I think community organizing is the essence of what's made progress in this country. What was the abolitionist movement, but a kind of community organizing? What was the suffragette movement, but a kind of community organizing? So pick your community, get organized, and let's make progress for justice and peace. Yes, ma'am. That I think is marvelous about now, I was arguing to some students earlier over dinner that I don't buy the whole generational bullshit about, you know, I'm a person of the 60s and you are people of whatever you're of. I don't buy that because I'm as much a person of this generation as you are, and I'm still here, and I expect when the revolution comes you'll push me to the barricades in my wheelchair or whatever, as a metaphor. I said earlier that I don't think that it makes any sense to talk in terms of decades. I think that's all myth and media. I mean, I don't remember on December 31st, 1969, looking at my watch and saying, "Oh shit, it's about to end. I better get laid or something." I mean, it just doesn't work like that. You know, the world it keeps going. The world keeps going. So the idea that we had everything right then and everything screwed up now is bullshit. So I think that we have a different moment that we're living in. And one of the things that I think is important is not to let the kind of mythology of the 60s sit on us like a kind of a wet blanket, like everything good happened then and everything now is less than or is kind of in light of. It's not true. And one of the ways it's not true is exactly the internet. I think that communication, access to information, not always knowledge, but information, humor and art are some of the great aspects of today that we should not underestimate. There's a reason that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and The Onion are the most reliable sources of information in the country. I couldn't live without them. I don't trust NPR as far as I can throw it. I can't stand the softwood stuff. And I know I listen to it like an addict, and I read the New York Times. Absolutely, I feel like I'm putting heroin in my veins. But I do those things. But it's really to Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert that I turn to get the... And part of the reason they're so great, I've figured this out late, but I think it's true, is that humor is generous and embracing and participatory. And you can laugh your way to a different truth. And earnestness always feels self-righteous. It always feels like, you know, why are you preaching to me? You know, and yet... Colbert makes the same point so much better, you know, than the pontificators on either side. I remember when, there's so many examples, recent as well as, but I remember when, what's his name? one of the right-wing commentators was on Colbert, and he said at some point, he said, William Crystal, and he said, you know, I know there weren't any weapons of mass destruction, but we still had to go in there because he was a dictator killing his own people. And of course, I would have immediately gotten in a fight with Crystal, right? But not Colbert. Colbert said, I agree with you, sir. We have every reason to go in there, and we ought to go into Syria. And Crystal, maybe that's possible. And Saudi, he said, and North Korea. And Crystal, well, I don't know about North Korea, sir. A dictator killing his own people. And China. And Crystal's like, no. It's so absurd, but it's making it absurd that makes it true, that makes you see the truth of it. And I think if I were butting heads with William Crystal, it'd be a disaster, and you wouldn't learn anything. But Stephen Colbert taking him down in Primrose Path, really. And then when you see Jon Stewart go at, what's his name? Who did he go at last week or 2 weeks ago?
Jim Cramer,
Jesus. I mean, it was so great, and I think it was Eric Alterman compared it to Edward R. Murrow taking on the Army McCarthy people. You know, what did he do? He just slammed him, and he just put him in his place and just shamed him, and same with Tucker Carlson. So he can do that because he's got our confidence, because he's funny. And he couldn't do it if he were just an earnest blowhard like the rest of them. Something beautiful about that. So I don't know, that's a long way around. I'm so incompetent on it. You know, one of the things I do know, and I've seen this in my own family. In my family, we have three kids. And the three kids are what we call digital natives. Like, they live in that land. And my partner and I are digital immigrants. We speak with an accent. So you know, like Bernadine said to one of them last year, can I do such and such on my computer? And they looked at her like she was from Mars. Do what on your computer? You know, can I do this? Can I buy things on my computer? Good Lord. You know, it's like, it's just a language that we'll never master, but you will and have, and that's great. I'm going to just do two more because you guys are going to all fall out, but we can stick around and talk as long as you like. Yes, sir, and then two students, and that'll be it.
I'm just wondering, I think the Obama campaign put a lot of organizers that hadn't done organizing before. I think they made a lot of inroads and had a lot of success beyond just, you know, turning out voters and an election and electoral victory. And they're trying to basically put 600 community organizers across the country and build on that. I think, though, a lot of people are a little uncomfortable with the notion of it being part of the DNC and are uncomfortable with the fact that it's basically, you know, approaching a huge party apparatus and almost an authoritarian way. I just wondering what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I'm understanding you correctly, I think the nervousness about being in the Democratic Party is well placed. I would be nervous if I were in the Democratic Party. And why? Because it's, you know, the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, is not actually a party in the sense that it's neither disciplined nor does it have a political line. It doesn't have any. You don't join the Democratic Party and get disciplined. The Democratic Party is a collection of blocks, and so is the Republican Party. So one of the things you're watching in the Republican Party and watched since Bush's second election is the blocks coming apart. You know, the religious block, the nutty block, the traditional conservative block, the neocon block, they all fell apart. And they were held together by some magic tape. Well, the same is true of the Democratic Party. So if you go into the Democratic Party, and God help you if you do, but if you do, and I know a lot of people do it, and a lot of you probably are, that's okay. But always maintain your independence. And that's true of any party you would go into, incidentally. If you go to the Communist Party, maintain your independence. That is, have a mind of your own and don't allow yourself to kind of drink the Kool-Aid and become a little troop for the indefensible. There are many, many examples of people who've done this. I can point you to one thing I think all of you should read. Is that too professorial? Can I tell you what?
Tell us.
I'll tell you what the hell. You should all read Edward Said's brilliant book, Representations of the Intellectual. I know, it's a clumsy title. I told him you should call it Sex, Drugs, and Intellectual. But I got an audience. It's a tiny little book, Representations of the Intellectual. It's his lectures on the BBC about 10 years ago. And what he argues there is that it's the responsibility of intellectuals, and he he needs a pretty broad definition of what that is, and includes students and teachers. The responsibility is to maintain an independent line in your own head, to never, ever bow down to the orthodoxy of whatever party you're a part of. And Said is a great example, when he's read honestly, he's a great example of a contradiction that's hard for anybody to imagine doing. The Palestinian people never had a greater champion than Edward Said, and the Palestinian leadership never had a harsher critic. And there's something pretty wonderful about that, if you think about it. To defend humanity and hate the idiots who are, you know, kind of running humanity into the ground, that's pretty sweet. So I would say if you go into the Democratic Party, maintain one part of yourself in the anti-war movement, in the peace movement, in the environmental movement. I think that's really important. You had something else to say.
Yes, I'm from Chicago, and I work for Commonwealth Edison.
That's a great company. Once.
Well, the time your father ran it, and you were active in your underground activities, of course, caused your father great embarrassment and compromised his ability to run the company.
Do you think?
I know, because I experienced it.
I ran the country.
What was your relationship with your father, and how did you compromise things?
For those of you who don't know, my father was the chairman of Commonwealth Edison. He was the youngest president of Commonwealth Edison. Commonwealth Edison was the electric monopoly. Yeah, I guess you guys have it in Southern California. What's it called?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's inconsequential.
I'm sorry?
It doesn't matter. That's inconsequential.
No, but I'm just saying. I'm just telling people so you don't know what your reference is. So my dad was the chairman of Commonwealth Edison, and when Martin Luther King came to Chicago, my father was the chief negotiator between King, Daley, and the real estate boards, and every day I was marching in Cicero with King, and then I'd go home and talk to my dad at dinner. It was kind of sweet. And my father, of course, disagreed with a lot of things I did, but you can look up an interview he did with Connie Chung in 1996 in which he defended me pretty unequivocally. And he was he was like a lot of parents. He didn't agree with what I did, certainly never had saw eye to eye politically. At the end of his life, we had huge differences about gay rights until I kept saying to him, if any guy wants to marry you, Dad, I'll defend you. You know, to marry anyone. But my dad developed dementia, and my mother did first and lived with me, and then my father moved in and lived with me for the last 5 years of his life. And we were very, very close. And we were a very close family. Certainly the years I was underground, we didn't see each other. But when I came back above ground, his first comment to me was, I had hair about the length of your hair, and his first comment to me was, damn, you need a haircut. I thought, holy shit, 11 years I haven't seen the guy. And the first thing we were, it's such a parental thing, it's so sweet. But I would say we were very, very close for most all of our lives except for that 10 years, which was pretty rough. And I felt bad for both of my parents, but they weathered it somehow. And we remained close. Generous guy. Yes, I have two in the back, and then I'm going to stop. Yes?
Should teaching social justice in schools really be a priority when some of our students aren't being taught math and science properly? And also, can you comment on your earlier comment about Michelle Obrey and her journey to bring accountability to DC schools?
I don't think she's bringing accountability. I think she's bringing a narrowing. I mean, look, the problem with what's called accountability, and that's another example where we're kind of in a metaphor more, where you say accountability and you immediately think, hold those goddamn teachers accountable for test scores. That's what accountability means. I have a different way of looking at accountability. I think the city of Chicago, the state of Illinois, and the United States of America should be accountable for the fact that kids in Chicago get far less than kids in Winnetka. That's wrong. It's wrong in a democracy. So I want the government to be accountable to the parents. That's one. So I want to change the frame. Here's the other thing about the notion that we've all bought, that accountability is kind of good and tests are one way of seeing whether anybody's doing anything. If what you say to teachers is you will be judged on two things, on whether your kids raise their scores slightly on a reading test, which is disconnected from it, and whether they raise their scores slightly on a math test. That's what you're going to be judged on. You don't have to be brilliant as a teacher to know that that's what you're going to do. So in Chicago, we have no arts, we have no physical education, we have no sports, we have no clubs, we have no games, we have no involvement in civic responsibility or community, you know, community service. Why should we? That's not how you're going to judge a teacher. But if you had an accountability system that said, a testing system, an assessment system, that said, the 25 things that we actually charge our schools with doing are the things we're going to look at, then yes, the schools would look different. So none of you guys, none of you in this room, went to schools where all they did was drill and kill on reading and math. You didn't go to that school. And even Chester Finn and Diane Ravitch, the two conservative education critics who served in the Reagan administration, even those two came out a month ago and said, if No Child Left Behind is reauthorized, the only schools in America that will teach citizens are rich suburban schools and rich private schools. The rest of the kids are going to get screwed. And that's what's happening in Chicago. So I think, no, I think we should not judge a school or a kid. And think about your own life. I mean, you guys come from, you know, as I do, you come from privilege. And so the chance of recovering when you make a mistake, the chance of, you know, of doing teenage things and still landing on your feet is high. But that's not true for the kids on the west side of Chicago. It seems to me that's grotesquely unfair and not worthy of education and democracy. So you think about testing, for example. It's easy to test for things like, can you think critically? It's not hard. What if we had a high school test that said, I want you to write one paragraph in defense of gay marriage, and now I want you to write a paragraph opposing gay marriage, and cite your sources and, you know, use evidence and argument. That'd be a good test. That's not what we're doing. We're doing the stupidest kind of testing for the lowest level. So that's in general. The other thing, I guess, I think, is that you know, the SAT is just a gate. The SATs are just a gate. We were debating something at my college about what exams would be used to get into the PhD program. And I said, the SATs are just a gate. Whatever you got on your SAT, you sweated it out, and you really had to do well so you could get to, you know, Pritzker or whatever, right? Nobody ever asks you what you got in your SAT after you get there. Is that true? Mm-hmm. And one of my colleagues said, he's 50 or 60 years old, he said, and I've been pissed about that ever since because I got an 800 on math. Nobody's ever asked that. So you got to say it. But nobody cares. It's a gate. It's a gate you go through. It's not a predictor of much. But it is a gate you have to go through so you get into a college like this.
It's also a business.
So, you know, my kids took AP Physics and did very well on math exams and all that. And then one went to Brown, and one went to Yale, and one went to Cal. And they never took another science class in their lives. What was the point? What was all that? Well, it was a gate. It was a proof that you could do it. And I don't know that that's worth very much in terms of an educated citizen. Really, it's a waste of money. Somebody else, last person. Yes, sir.
I think it's interesting that you call education a right. What's a right to you, and do you think any are being abused right now in this country?
Say it again.
What is a right to you, and do you think any are being abused right now in this country?
What is a right to me, and do I think any are being abused? I'm not sure where you're going with that. A right is something that's kind of, what's a right? I carry around with me the UN Declaration of Human Rights. I think that's a good place to start. And one of the things it says in Article 1, sorry, it's all been through the laundry a few times. But Article 1, which I think is really important, this is a right. After the preamble, Article 1, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They're endowed with reason and conscience and should act toward one another in the spirit of brotherhood and sisterhood. That's a pretty good place to start. Very hard standard to live up to, but it's a good place to start. And it makes me want to end by reading a little passage. Could I? Just a little short thing. Okay, let me read this. You got to think who wrote this, okay? As I was finishing up at my table, a man in a thin wool sweater appeared out of nowhere and asked if he could buy me coffee. He spoke no English, and his Spanish wasn't much better than mine, but he had a winning smile and the urgency of someone in need of company. We were both on our way to Barcelona from Madrid. Standing at the bar, he told me he was from Senegal and was crisscrossing Spain for seasonal work. He showed me a battered photograph he kept in his wallet of a young girl with a round, smooth face. His wife, he said, he had to leave her behind, but he hoped they would reunite soon. What was his name? I couldn't remember now, just another hungry man far away from home, one of the many children of the former colonies, Algerians, West Indians, Pakistanis, now breaching the barricades of their former masters, mounting their own ragged, haphazard invasion. And yet, as we walked toward the Ramblas, I had felt as if I knew him as well as any man, that coming from opposite ends of the earth, we were somehow on the same journey. I settled on the fact that this man from Senegal had bought me coffee and offered me water, and that was real, and maybe that was all any of us had the right to expect. The chance encounter, a shared story, the act of small kindness, and the possibility of a new world. Who wrote that?
Obama.
Barack Obama, Dreams of My Father. He's written too. And I think it's interesting, again, that a man with consciousness like this is in that place. It doesn't tell me he's going to save us. It tells me we better save him by building a movement for justice and peace and get busy tonight. Thanks very much.